I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's February 15th, and we have a lot to talk about. With hospital rates starting to decline and mask mandates being lifted in several states, there seems to be a general feeling that we're seeing the COVID-19 pandemic begin its wind down as it transitions to becoming an endemic virus. And we have to wonder what that means, not just for all of us, but especially for people living with MS, some of whom are immunocompromised. Dr. Nancy Sicott is joining me today to talk about the preventative treatments for COVID-19 that are available today for people who are living with MS, the importance of receiving 4 doses of the COVID-19 mRNA vaccines if you're living with MS, and some of the things we should be thinking about as we begin this transition from pandemic to endemic. Dr. Sicott is a professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, and Dr. Sicott also chairs the MS Society's National Medical Advisory Committee, and she leads the COVID-19 Advisory Group. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Nancy Sicott, there are a few other things that you should know about. We celebrate Black history and culture during the month of February, and as we recognize the many achievements of African Americans, we should also acknowledge the ongoing work necessary to ensure equal treatment for all. Historically, members of the Black community haven't received equal medical treatment, and ironically, evidence shows that multiple sclerosis itself doesn't treat members of the Black community equally either. Recently, I had the opportunity to talk with Dr. Jacqueline Rosenthal about how MS impacts Black people differently. Dr. Rosenthal is a neurologist at the Shepherd Center's Andrew C. Carlos Multiple Sclerosis Institute in Atlanta. And in a moment, we'll meet Dr. Jacqueline Rosenthal. MS impacts people of all ages, sexual orientations, racial, and ethnic backgrounds. But that doesn't make MS an equal opportunity disease. Research shows that MS impacts members of some minority populations differently. And joining me to discuss how MS impacts members of the Black community is Dr. Jacqueline Rosenthal. Dr. Rosenthal is a neurologist at the Shepherd Center's Andrew C. Carlos Multiple Sclerosis Institute in Atlanta. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Rosenthal.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
When I think about the health disparities that affect members of the Black community who are living with MS, they tend to fall into one of two categories. There are the disparate aspects of the disease course itself, the ways that MS impacts Black people differently. And then there are the systemic or institutional inequities that create extra and significant burdens for members of the Black community. Let's talk about the disease-related disparities first. Are there some clinical characteristics of MS that are different among Black people?
There are, and it really makes for a potentially more severe MS course. And so what we as MS providers and what we have noticed and what we've seen in the little bit of research that has been published about the MS disease course in Black MS patients is that the MS tends to progress a little bit more rapidly. The relapses occur more frequently. They can be more severe. We see that the recovery in between relapses is oftentimes more incomplete or poor for Black MS patients. We're also seeing that Black MS patients seem to transition to that secondary progressive MS phase sooner than their white counterparts. And so these are just a few of the things that we are seeing. Clinically, we're also seeing some MRI changes that look more pronounced in our Black MS patients.
Is the proportion of MS subtypes, like relapsing, remitting, or progressive MS, is that proportion different in the Black MS community?
I don't think that we've necessarily seen a big difference between the relapsing remitting versus primary progressive, but there is some suggestion that there's a higher amount of the secondary progressive MS in the Black community. So that goes along with that faster progression to the faster time to developing progressive MS.
What about age of onset? Are there differences in age among Black people when it comes to the initial onset of MS?
So there's been a lot of conflicting data with that. You know, there's at least one study that showed that Black MS patients develop MS earlier, and then there's one that suggested later. Those two studies were on different parts of the country, East Coast versus West Coast. And so there's some suspicion that maybe there's some geographic or environmental factors that may be influencing it. But there's a big to be determined on that one. We're not quite sure.
What about disease modifying therapies? Have any DMTs been shown to be either more or less effective for Black people who are living with MS?
To my knowledge, I can't recall any study showing that a particular disease modifying treatment has been found to be more effective in Black MS patients. There was an older study, a small study, that suggested that the interferons group of medications were less effective in Black MS patients. We always talk about NEDA, or no evidence of disease activity, which is ultimately our goal, right, is to kind of halt the disease process. But showing that being less able to accomplish that goal with some of those medications, when we look at there's such low numbers, honestly, of Black patients enrolled in our clinical trials, which is what we use to make decisions about the efficacy of treatments. So oftentimes what we're left with are going back to these studies and pulling out the handful of Black MS patients there are. You know, we're talking about 10, 15, 20 patients out of hundreds and thousands of patients, and trying to draw conclusions about the efficacy of those treatments. And it's really difficult because the numbers are just too low. And so there have been, fortunately, individuals who have taken the time to dig into this a little bit more and look at particular drugs more in depth in the Black MS community. Those results in those particular drugs like dimethyl fumarate or ocrelizumab and that sort of thing certainly look encouraging that these MS treatments are as effective. But there's definitely more information to be gathered when looking at MS treatment as a whole.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the low number of members of the Black community and, frankly, any minority community participating in clinical trials. I've often heard MS clinical trial participants described as a bunch of old white women. So help us understand that it's not just a matter of diversity for diversity's sake. Why is it important to recruit more diverse participants to clinical trials?
Right. So, clinical trials, the whole purpose, right, are you have this intervention, this drug or whatever it is that you're looking at to see, does it make a difference? And with that, you have these participants and you try to make them as equal as possible so that the only difference is that particular intervention, that drug, that gives us the best information. We're controlling for race, gender, socioeconomic status, all of these things that we can kind of pull out and say, okay, the differences between the group that was on this particular intervention or treatment versus the one that wasn't was solely that intervention. And that's what tells us, that's evidence-based medicine. That's what we use to make decisions off of. And when there is a group of people left out, it makes it incredibly difficult to take those study results and then apply it to that group of individuals that aren't there. And so, like you said, really any minority. So, if you look at Native Americans, Hispanics, Black Americans, there's a lot of people that based on the clinical trial data, it's very difficult to apply that information to them directly.
I've heard some researchers say that cultural differences within some minority populations can delay when or even how someone who's a member of those populations might seek treatment for any chronic condition, including MS. Is this something that's true in the Black community?
I do. I think cultural differences certainly play a role in any community. And in the Black community, we do see that sometimes there is mistrust towards the medical community, and that can delay diagnosis. Sometimes they're based on an individual's experience. There may have been a bad experience that now has kind of put a bad taste in their mouth, and they're just kind of now less likely to go to the doctor or follow up with doctors. Even if there's an initial problem that really warranted medical attention, there may be a lack of follow through in terms of really honing in on the diagnosis or treatment plan. And so that certainly contributes. And I also think that sometimes there's a tendency to keep going and maybe not necessarily ignoring symptoms, but just kind of pushing through. That's a strong thing to do and you know, do the things that you need to do. And that also can contribute to that delay in diagnosis.
I've heard from some of my listeners who have reached out through email and shared with me that they've actually had their MS diagnosis delayed because the doctor treating them told them Black people can't get MS. Let's talk about that, and maybe we can expand and you can tell us about some of the other barriers that Black people living with MS face when they're trying to access healthcare.
I mean, yeah, unfortunately, I've heard those stories as well. And Black people certainly get multiple sclerosis. They get them in equal, if not higher numbers than proportion-wise than white people with MS as of late. That's what the latest data has shown us. And, you know, a lot of that comes from you thinking that with that misinformation about Black people can't get MS, sometimes providers or diagnosticians will start looking elsewhere. They'll start considering other diagnoses, and MS may not even be on the radar. Or when it is, years have passed and disability has kind of taken hold. And so then that also contributes when you talk about the MS being more severe in Black MS patients, but that's part of the problem too. That's part of why it's likely occurring. And so looking at that, looking at the fact that it's possible, it's likely that Black MS patients aren't getting to the MS specialist as early and as frequently as they need to as well. And so those are some of the barriers that are faced. Obviously, there are socioeconomic barriers and that sort of thing that will limit access to care, which also has huge impacts on just overall diagnosis, treatment, prognosis.
Oh, we can have a whole conversation about how the social determinants of health impact health outcomes among members of the Black community and underserved communities who are living with MS, certainly.
Absolutely.
Well, clearly, we have important work to do, but it's difficult to fix anything until you first identify the problem. Dr. Jacqueline Rosenthal, thank you for helping us better understand the problem. Thank you for all you do every day to solve the problem and improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
We're 2 years into a pandemic that's cost the lives of over 900,000 Americans and millions more around the world. It's not hyperbole to say COVID-19 has in some way changed the lives of every person on Earth. Now, after 2 years of lockdowns and restrictions, things are beginning to change. Mask restrictions are being lifted. Treatments for COVID-19 are available. And the latest COVID-19 variant doesn't seem to pose a threat of serious illness to people who have been vaccinated and boosted. But what happens next for people living with MS? What about people who are on B-cell depleting disease-modifying therapies like Ocrevus? As the world transitions from pandemic to endemic, what does the future look like if you happen to be immunocompromised? In a moment, Dr. Nancy Sicott joins me to talk about COVID-19 and what's next if you're living with MS. COVID-19 has impacted the way we work, the way we go to school, the way we socialize with family and friends. It's truly changed the way we live. And many of us, especially people who are affected by MS, we're wondering, what comes next? Joining us today to talk about where we are in the COVID-19 pandemic and what the future may hold for people living with MS is a friend of this podcast, Dr. Nancy Sicott. Dr. Sicott is professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. And Dr. Sicott also chairs the MS Society's National Medical Advisory Committee and leads the COVID-19 Advisory Group. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Sicott.
Thank you, John. Always a pleasure to be here.
For the past 2 years, COVID-19 has upended what many people would call the normalcy of daily life. Experts seem to agree that this virus isn't going away anytime soon, but there's hope that the COVID-19 vaccines and new treatment options could move us from a pandemic to an endemic. So to get us started, I'm hoping you'll explain the difference between a pandemic and an endemic.
Yeah, so it is a little confusing, but what we started with the COVID-19 virus was an epidemic. That was the infection got started in China. Then it spread to the rest of the world, so that made it a pandemic. And it's this term is used for novel infections. So the whole world is vulnerable, and we've seen that because it's a novel infectious agent. Over time, with enough people getting exposed, and with our vaccines, this turns into little pockets of infection, which is what an endemic infection is. So this means that it never goes away completely. It sort of pops up here and there. It may have some seasonality to it. So just like the flu, it may show, and we've seen with our surges, that certainly around the holiday seems to be a very active time. So it is become something that we learn to live with the way we learn to live with the flu, for example, and is just something that is out there, but we have some inherent immunity to it so that it doesn't impact us the way that the pandemic has over these last 2 years.
So I'll ask the question that the whole world is waiting to hear the answer to. How long is that going to take till we get to that endemic stage?
Yes, I wish I could tell you with authority that it's exactly this date. I think it's a process. I think a lot of people feel that the Omicron surge that was so incredible in terms of the numbers of people that were affected and infected gets us closer to that state because we have a little bit more of what they call herd immunity, which then prevents the virus from being able to take off and infect large groups of people at the same time. But I also have to recognize we need to be humble. The virus has certainly humbled us many times during the last 2 years. And so we'll have to wait and see. But it does appear that between vaccination and this latest surge, that the virus will have a harder time rearing its head the way it has and spreading so widely and affecting so many people at once.
So once we get to that endemic stage and COVID-19 becomes another seasonal virus like the flu, what can we expect when it comes to things like mask wearing, booster shots, and the other prevention strategies that we've become all too accustomed to?
Yeah, so I do think we're going to be living with these kinds of measures, and certainly we will need to be doing these things until we get more confidence and more experience with what an endemic state will look like with COVID-19. And then I think what we'll have to start thinking about is really looking at people's risk profile. And people will have to make these kinds of decisions based on how likely they are to get infected or how likely they are to have a severe infection. And so for many, that will include continuing to be careful, to continue to use masks, especially when they're in crowded places, maybe avoiding crowded places. And then I do think boosters are in our future. Whether that will be yearly, the way we do with the flu, I think that remains to be seen. But we might expect, very similar to the flu, that there'll be different variants will be planned for, and we'll have boosters that will vary depending on what version of the virus is most prominent out in the world. So I do think we're not going to turn the page immediately and to a COVID-free world. We're going to have stepwise getting used to living with the virus amongst us.
We know that COVID-19 vaccines are safe for people with MS and everyone should get vaccinated. But we also know that certain disease-modifying therapies may actually prevent some individuals from mounting an adequate immune response. Which DMTs are we talking about here, and what does that mean for the people who take them?
So what we learned through the pandemic, mainly from excellent work, epidemiology work that's been done looking at these disease modifying therapies and risk, as well as vaccine responses, it turns out that it's not every disease modifying therapy that impacts these risks and vaccine responses. There's really two classes that have turned out to have this effect. The first is the B-cell depleters, and that includes medications such as rituximab, ocrelizumab, ofatumumab. These are monoclonal antibodies against CD20, and they cause a drop in B-cells. These are so-called anti-CD20 B-cell depleting drugs. The other class are the S1P inhibitors. That includes fingolimod, pisanimod. I'm blocking the other name, but there are several of these that are on the market now as well. So it's these two classes of medications that we have seen after vaccination lower levels of neutralizing antibodies, which is how vaccine responses are typically measured in the general population.
Someone may be listening to our conversation, wondering why it's important for them to still get vaccinated if they're not going to mount an immune response.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And we do have data to support the fact that you still should get vaccinated. First of all, antibodies are only one arm of the immune response. Another part of the immune response are cells, T cells in particular, and T cell responses are very important in protecting you from developing severe disease. And we have seen that with these medications, even though neutralizing antibodies may not be elevated, T cell responses do seem to respond, especially with the B cell depleting drugs. The other thing that we have seen is that individuals who are on these medications and vaccinated do better than people who are on these medications and not vaccinated if they get COVID. So, and then we may talk about this later, but getting access to some other newer medications requires you to have gone through the immunization process and get your full panoply of vaccines. So these are all good reasons why people should continue to get vaccinated, even if they're on these other medications.
For people who are immunocompromised, the National MS Society guidance is that they should get a total of 4 doses if they initially received one of the mRNA vaccines, and that's either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. Do I have that right?
Yes, it's very confusing, but people who are immunocompromised, and actually this includes all MS patients who are on immunomodulators and immunosuppressing medications, are eligible to have a 3-shot regimen as their initial vaccine regimen. So for the rest of us, it's 2 shots for the mRNA, but if you are on one of these medications, then 3 shots is what you get for your initial vaccination series, and then your booster would be 5 months after the 3rd shot that you got as your initial vaccine series. So for those who are not immunocompromised, 2+1. For those who are immunocompromised or on these medications, 3+1.
And while we're talking about vaccines, I also noticed that the MS Society is now recommending one of the mRNA vaccines over the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for people who are living with MS. What prompted that change?
So that was some data that came out showing that booster responses for people who had initially received the J&J vaccine were better if they were boosted with one of the mRNA vaccines. And then also we have learned that the J&J vaccine can have some risks. They're small, but there are risks of things such as blood clots in younger women. And that tends to be represent a large group of people who are living with MS. So for those reasons, we are recommending boosters be done with the mRNA versions.
COVID-19 vaccines remain the best first defense against becoming infected. But as you mentioned a moment ago, now there are medications available to treat COVID-19 and to use before and after exposure to COVID-19. So can you tell us what a monoclonal antibody treatment is?
Yeah, so these are the miracle drugs, the smart bombs. These are manufactured proteins that are very highly specific in what they do. And as we talked about in MS, we use monoclonal antibodies to target B cells. But there are monoclonal antibodies that have been developed that target the COVID, the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19. And we have a variety of options in that class.
The FDA authorized a monoclonal antibody treatment to use as a preventative therapy after someone's exposed to COVID-19, specifically for people who are at high risk for severe COVID. Now, are all people with MS considered to be at risk for severe COVID-19?
Thankfully, John, no. Most people living with MS are not at risk for severe COVID because they are on the disease-modifying therapies that don't interfere with vaccine responses and that don't increase their risk of severe COVID, and they are otherwise healthy. So the vast majority of people who live with MS are not at risk for severe COVID. So I think that's an important message to get out there. There are, of course, some people living with MS who are at high risk, and those would be people who are on some of those medications that we talked about where they may not mount an adequate vaccine response, or they live with disability, or they have other comorbidities such as obesity, diabetes, lung disease, and so forth. So these would be the people that are prioritized to receive these kinds of preventative medications.
Now, some monoclonal antibody infusion therapies are used to prevent hospitalization and lessen COVID-19 symptom severity. Should everyone diagnosed with COVID-19 automatically receive this therapy?
So again, the answer to that question would be no. And really, we want to prioritize those individuals who are at the highest risk for developing severe COVID. And I will just tell you that this is obviously a very evolving field, because we know one of the first monoclonal antibody infusion therapies, known as Regeneron, is actually not used now because it doesn't seem to have any impact against Omicron. So it was developed for the original version of the virus. But there is another version of an IV monoclonal antibody called sotrovimab. Sotrovimab is only available in small amounts currently. It's in short supply. But this is a single infusion for people with mild to moderate COVID who are at risk for severe disease. And then you also mentioned the medication for those who are at risk for severe disease or who are not expected to mount an adequate vaccine response that could be given even before exposure or before disease develops. And that's the drug called Evusheld. And that is the combination of monoclonal antibodies. And there are certain subsets of MS patients that may be eligible for those. So the monoclonals are a really important part of this armamentarium that we're developing to both potentially prevent and then to treat, to prevent severe COVID and to treat those individuals who have developed symptoms.
Now, I know oral antivirals are also available now to treat COVID-19. Who should receive an oral antiviral?
Again, the risk stratification here is important. So these medications are all indicated for those who are at risk for severe COVID. So there is a medication called Paxlovid. These are two antivirals that are given as oral medication over a 5-day period for those who have mild to moderate COVID, but who are at high risk for severe disease. I just want to emphasize, again, the supply is rather limited, although I think that's getting better, but there's also multiple interactions with other medications. So this has to be considered carefully when you're weighing the risks and benefits. And there is also another oral medication called Molnupiravir, which is an oral antiviral that's also given over 5 days, also for high-risk patients, people who are expected to have severe COVID. It's not as effective as Paxlovid, but it's easier to give in terms of the drug-drug interactions. So as you can see, we have a variety of options that are available to us. And Remdesivir, which is also an antiviral, is also still available. That's an infusion therapy. And it seems as though that's for people who are inpatients, who have been admitted to the hospital for COVID, and seems to work against the Omicron variant as well.
Now, how can someone with COVID-19 determine whether they should be receiving a monoclonal antibody infusion or one of the oral antivirals?
Yeah, so I think it's a great question. I think individuals living with MS should know their risk profile. So there are calculators available out there where you can calculate your risk for developing severe COVID, and you can mitigate that risk by doing some things like getting vaccinated. That decreases your risk substantially. But those who are on those medications we talked about, the B-cell depleters and the S1P inhibitors, who are not expected to or have had a bone marrow transplant, there are some of our patients who have had bone marrow transplants. They're also in that group. They're not expected to mount as good a vaccine response, and especially if they have other risk factors like age, disability, and those other comorbidities we talked about, they should definitely be considered for to have access to these therapies. And that involves contacting your primary care as well as your neurologist and having those conversations about what to do should you get infected.
You know, we're beginning to see a shift in how people are thinking about and talking about COVID-19. It's starting to be considered just another part of everyday life instead of something that requires lockdowns and some of the strict preventive measures we've all experienced. How is this shift in the public mindset and in public policy going to impact people who are immunocompromised?
So I think this is a really good question, John, and really a difficult one. And I don't think that we're going to have the answer to this immediately. I think this is a process. And I think it's something that those of us who care for people living with MS who are immunocompromised will really need to be thinking about. And I know we've been talking about this in our vaccine task force, because this really is the next phase. How do we move people from a place of fear, where a lot of our patients have been living for the last 2 years, into a space of cautious optimism and trust? And I think that we certainly are not going to recommend people fling off their masks and go to the movies and put themselves at risk. But I do think as time goes on, we will build confidence in our ability to manage the virus, to know that it's something that is not a death sentence, that people can be treated if they should become infected, and that we're going to have to balance this risk with the many benefits of getting out in the world. I'll share an anecdote. I was doing at one day a week, I do video visits, and I had 7 or 8 patients on my morning list. Half of them that morning either had COVID or were just getting over COVID. None of them had called me. None of them had severe symptoms. None of them went to the hospital. Several of them are on medications on that, the B-cell depleters in particular. And all of them were vaccinated, of course. So it just really struck me that in contrast to the early stages of the pandemic, this was something that people sort of took in stride. And I think, again, the Omicron variant definitely seems to produce milder disease. And in combination with the vaccine, then people can start to feel like this is something that is manageable. So I think we'll be moving slowly forward and developing that confidence. And then as we talked about these other options for people who aren't going to have a good vaccine response, like Evusheld is something to be considered. I think that's another layer of protection that our certain individuals living with MS would be eligible for.
Well, Dr. Nancy Sicotte, thank you for sharing what I think is a really important and timely update. Thanks for all that you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And once again, thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you, John. My pleasure. And I look forward to updating the MS community as we continue our work on the task force.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/233. You'll find that link in today's show notes so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. If you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free RealTalk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of RealTalk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes, and it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.